Stephen King's Firestarter burst onto the literary scene in 1980, becoming an instant bestseller that cemented King's reputation as the master of horror with heart. The novel follows the harrowing journey of Andy McGee and his pyrokinetic daughter, Charlie, as they flee a shadowy government agency. The book's exploration of unethical experimentation and the corrupting influence of power resonated deeply with post-Watergate America, where distrust of government had become commonplace. When adapted into a film starring Drew Barrymore in 1984, it further embedded itself in pop culture, with celebrities like Quentin Tarantino citing it as one of King's most underrated works. Beyond its thrilling narrative, Firestarter raises profound questions about parental protection, government overreach, and the moral responsibilities that come with extraordinary abilities, themes that continue to make it relevant over four decades later. Andy McGee hurries through the crowded streets of New York City, carrying his exhausted 8-year-old daughter Charlie, constantly glancing over his shoulder at a green car following them. The pedestrian-filled avenues offer little protection as two men in business suits emerge from the vehicle, shouting "Police!" when Andy manages to flag down a taxi. In a moment of desperation, Andy uses his extraordinary mental ability, what he calls a push, to convince the cab driver that the men are after someone else. This mental exertion causes him excruciating pain, but he manages one final push to convince the driver to take them to Albany for $500, though he only has a single dollar in his pocket. As Charlie sleeps against his shoulder, Andy's mind drifts to earlier that day when he'd pulled her from school, narrowly escaping agents from The Shop, a covert government organization. His thoughts turn darker as he remembers his wife Vicky, tortured and killed after they pulled out four of her fingernails to make her talk. The memory triggers a flashback to 12 years earlier, when a 22-year-old Andy participated in an experiment run by Dr. Wanless, a balding man with the odd habit of shredding cigarettes between his fingers. Wanless had explained they would be injecting half the participants with water and half with Lot 6, a classified compound with mild hallucinogenic properties. Andy had gotten involved through his roommate Quincy Tremont, who suggested it as a quick way to make $200. Though hesitant, Andy needed the money. At the orientation, he met Vicky Tomlinson, a pretty auburn-haired girl whose psychology student boyfriend had forbidden her from participating. They connected immediately, and Andy offered to accompany her to the experiment, a decision that would irrevocably alter both their lives. Back in the present, Andy and Charlie arrive at Albany Airport after midnight. With his head throbbing from the mental exertion and no money for food or shelter, Andy reluctantly asks Charlie to use her own abilities to get them funds. Though crying because she knows stealing is wrong, Charlie agrees to help her suffering father. She takes a shopping bag and heads to the bank of payphones, wrestling with her conscience about using what they call the bad thing, her pyrokinetic ability to start fires with her mind. Since childhood, she's been warned never to use this power, as it's both dangerous and could expose them to the shop, who want to study and exploit them. Moving through the terminal largely unnoticed, Charlie uses her telekinetic ability to force coins from the payphones, collecting them in her shopping bag. But her control slips when she encounters a soldier named Eddie Delgado sitting in the terminal. Without meaning to, she sets his shoes on fire. The man screams and sprints across the concourse, bursting into the women's restroom where he plunges his feet into a toilet, creating a huge commotion. Charlie returns to Andy crying, confessing what happened. Despite his debilitating headache, Andy comforts her, explaining that this incident actually shows improvement in her control. Instead of severely injuring the man, she only burned his shoes. But their moment of relative calm is short-lived. The green car arrives at the airport 15 minutes after they leave, and the agents quickly learn about the shoe-burning incident, immediately recognizing Charlie's signature. As Andy and Charlie walk along the airport feeder road in darkness, they consider hitchhiking on the nearby Northway. Every step causes Andy throbbing pain, and Charlie senses the bad men are nearby. They decide to take a shortcut down an embankment, but both slip on the dry grass and tumble toward the highway. where cars speed past, a metaphorical descent into the dangerous situation that will define their lives from this moment forward. The Lot 6 experiment forever altered the trajectory of Andy and Vicky's lives. As the drug took effect, Andy witnessed disturbing scenes, a test subject clawing his own eyes out while the supposed graduate assistants rushed to help. The bloody hand of the victim rose from the huddle of white coats, leaving a crimson handprint on a brain chart. In that moment, Andy realized these weren't students at all, but government agents. He somehow knew one was named Ralph Baxter, who had killed 4 people. During their drug-induced state, Andy and Vicky discovered they could communicate telepathically. The drug created shared hallucinations and revealed deep personal secrets between them. When Andy awakened later, the graduate assistant denied any incidents had occurred, claiming it was all hallucination, though Andy remained deeply suspicious. After the experiment, Andy and Vicky compared their experiences in a union lounge. While Andy vividly remembered the bloody hand incident, Vicky recalled a blonde man with a scar setting up dominoes that she knocked over without touching them. They were puzzled by their shared hallucinations, wondering if the drug might have telepathic properties. Despite the disturbing experience, Andy told Vicky he was falling in love with her. Though nervous about relationships due to past trauma, she cautiously reciprocated his feelings. 5 days after the experiment, Andy convinced a reluctant Vicky to return to room 70 with him. When they arrived between classes, they discovered the brain chart with the blood stain had been replaced with an anatomical diagram. The chart made the same distinctive sound when it rolled up, a sound that would haunt Andy's dreams for the next 12 years. Years later, as they tumbled down the embankment along the Northway, Andy's mind continued to drift back to those pivotal days. After leaving the experiment, he'd walked across campus and stopped at Jason Gearney Hall, feeling an inexplicable chill. Compelled by disturbing half-memories, he convinced a security guard to let him in through strange mental persuasion that caused him mild head pain. Inside room 70, Andy discovered the chart with a bloodstain shaped like a comma. Frightened by imagined sounds and visions, he fled the building, pursued by echoes of his own footsteps. The experiment's aftermath was devastating. Of the 12 students who received Lot 6, 2 died immediately, 2 went insane, and 6 more eventually committed suicide, leaving only 2 survivors, Andy and Vicky McGee. Andy developed mental domination abilities, becoming what the shop classified as an X factor, while Victoria gained telekinetic powers as a Y factor. When they married and had Charlie, she manifested as the unknown Z factor, a pyrokinetic with abilities far more powerful than either of her parents. The consequences of that single experiment would follow them forever, eventually leading to their desperate flight from the shop, Vicky's murder, and their current predicament, fugitives with nowhere to turn and no one to trust. A van stops for Andy and Charlie, driven by Jim Paulson, a kind man with a beard and hillbilly hat whose vehicle features an Arabian Nights mural on the side. Immediately sensing they're running from something, Paulson doesn't press when Andy claims they're avoiding a process server. Despite his pounding migraine, Andy appreciates the driver's generosity when Paulson offers him $5. Charlie falls asleep against the driver's thigh as they travel toward the Slumberland Motel. When they arrive, Andy asks to be let off a short distance away to hide their lack of transportation. Paulson gives Andy $5 despite Andy's reluctance, saying, "Life is short and pain is long, and we were all put on this earth to help each other." Andy is moved to tears by this kindness before waking Charlie and heading to the motel. Inside, Andy signs in as Bruce Roselle with a fictitious car and company, United Vending Company of America, paying with loose change. When the night clerk asks if he can fix the cigarette machine, Andy claims it's not his brand. In their motel room, Charlie sleeps while Andy's mind races despite his exhaustion. They've been fugitives for about a year, though it hadn't felt like running when they settled in Port City, Pennsylvania, where Charlie attended first grade. He worries about how close their pursuers might be, possibly already in Albany, combing the airport. Andy recalls a painful incident when Charlie was a baby and he had to teach her not to use her fire-starting ability. After she burned her teddy bear, Andy confronted her harshly, showing her the charred bear and demanding, "Do you like Teddy to be all burned so you can't play with him anymore?" Though it broke his heart to frighten her so severely, he needed her to understand the danger. After she fell asleep crying, Andy called his friend Quincy, who cryptically warned him that of the 12 people who participated in the original experiment, only 4 remained alive. Quincy explained that one participant, who could bend keys and shut doors without touching them, was being kept in a locked room for testing, going slowly insane. He warned Andy that if authorities discovered Charlie's abilities, they might take her away to study her too, telling him to keep your head down. Andy lies awake in the motel room, haunted by Quincy's warning. He watches his sleeping daughter and wonders where they can go to be left alone, how their desperate flight will end. Meanwhile, not far away, a green cat, surveillance vehicle, continues searching for them through the darkness. The next day, 3 men in a green car approach the Northway. Norville Bates drives while John Mayo and Orville Jameson, OJ or the Juice, discuss their pursuit strategy. They've enlisted a local stringer with his wife posing as a concerned grandmother to check hotels. The men reminisce about the experiment in room 70, revealing that 12 students received lot 6, resulting in 2 deaths and 2 cases of insanity. They're confident they'll intercept Andy and Charlie trying to hitchhike. Their confidence is misplaced, however, as Andy and Charlie have already found temporary sanctuary at the Slumberland Motel. But their respite will be brief. The shop's resources are vast, and their determination to recapture the McGees is unwavering. The shop headquarters is revealed to be a secure government facility disguised as 2 southern plantation homes surrounded by electrified fences, guard dogs, and armed personnel in watchtowers. The entire compound is monitored by computer-controlled cameras, creating an impenetrable installation designed to hide its sinister purpose. An elderly man known as Cap arrives by bicycle at the facility. After passing security with a thumbprint scan, Cap enters the main building, exchanging pleasantries with the receptionist Josie, who has a concealed weapon in her desk drawer. In his office, Cap learns that Dr. Wanless is waiting to see him. Annoyed, Cap instructs his assistant Rachel to make Wanless wait, saying, "Just let him sit out there in the yellow parlor the whole friggin' morning." Rachel delivers the extensive McGee file, 6 boxes of papers, 4 boxes of photographs, and phone transcripts from bugs installed since 1978. Cap expects to have Andy and Charlie under surveillance by week's end, a thought that excites him. Reviewing the file, he finds a 1968 memo from a younger Wanless recommending testing Lot 6 on college students rather than convicts. Cap assigns Albert Steinowitz to take personal charge of capturing Andy and Charlie. Albert reports that roadblocks surround Albany in a 35-mile radius and explains his theory that Andy is likely incapacitated after overusing his mental domination ability. They examine a $1 bill Andy used to pay a cab driver, a bill that occasionally appears to show Ben Franklin's face instead of Washington's, demonstrating Andy's deteriorating mental push. Later, Dr. Joseph Wanless visits Cap, leaning on his cane with his stroke-damaged body. He's obsessed with the Lot 6 experiment and insists both Andy McGee and his daughter Charlie must be eliminated. Wanless explains that Lot 6 was a synthetic pituitary extract that enhanced psi abilities in test subjects. While Andy became an X factor with mental domination abilities and Victoria a Y factor with telekinetic powers, their daughter Charlie is the unknown Z factor. Wanless argues that Charlie's pyrokinetic ability was so dangerous as an infant that her parents had to fire train her like toilet training, creating psychological complexes against using her power. Now, with her father's guidance and under pressure, those complexes are breaking down. Wanless warns that when psychological complexes collapse, they go like dams bursting, making Charlie potentially catastrophically dangerous. Cap listens, but remains unmoved by the old doctor's apocalyptic warnings. After Wanless leaves, Cap receives a call from Orv Jamison reporting that all the payphones at the airport have been emptied of coins without being jimmied, clearly Charlie's work. While waiting for his next appointment, Cap calls Norville Bates in the field and orders an extreme sanction on Andy McGee, a euphemism for assassination. When John Rainbird arrives, Cap is struck by the man's unnerving presence, a 7-foot-tall Cherokee with horrific facial scarring from a Vietnam Claymore mine, missing his left eye. Despite his appearance, Rainbird possesses a brilliant mind, speaks multiple languages, and moves with supernatural silence. Cap offers him a volunteer job that might lead to something more interesting. After their 15-minute meeting, Cap feels drained but satisfied with the morning's progress, expecting news soon that Charlie has been captured and her father eliminated. What Cap doesn't realize is that Rainbird has his own agenda, one that will eventually bring the entire shop operation crashing down around them. Charlie McGee wakes in Unit 16 of the Slumberland Motel, watching her father sleep. In the shower, memories surface of her childhood, being scolded after accidentally setting her hair on fire, her parents' angry voices like boulders jumping down a mountainside, and the burned waffle smell of singed hair. At 5, her father had read her disturbing true stories instead of poo books, including tales of spontaneous human combustion. When Charlie cried, fearing she'd burn herself up, her parents explained her pyrokinetic, the ability to start fires with her mind when upset. Farmer Irv Manders picks up Andy and Charlie hitchhiking. Moved by their apparent hardship, he invites them home for lunch. Meanwhile, shop agents Knowles and Mayo find evidence at the motel that they've just missed the pair. At the farm, after Charlie enjoys a hearty lunch, Irv confronts Andy privately. Andy reveals they're fleeing the shop, the Department of Scientific Intelligence, and explains Charlie's pyrokinetic abilities. Charlie returns, sensing trouble, and whispers, "They're coming, Daddy." 16 shop agents, led by Al Steinowitz, converge on the farm. As Charlie grows agitated, the room temperature soars past 90 degrees. When agents charge the house with weapons drawn, Charlie unleashes her power. 3 men's hair ignite, gunfire erupts, and Irv is shot. As Steinowitz approaches, Charlie sets him ablaze. He collapses like a burning bundle of rags. Andy carries unconscious Charlie as flames consume the house. Though initially hostile, Norma helps Andy move the wounded Irv to safety. Irv, surprisingly understanding, defends them against the government's unlawful intrusion. When Charlie awakens, horrified by the destruction, she vows never to use her power again, though Irv counsels against absolute promises. Before they depart, Irv sketches an escape route through Woods Roads toward Vermont. His final words to Charlie are compassionate. "It sure wasn't your fault, Button. They brought it on themselves." The last image Andy sees is Irv supporting Norma, who can't bring herself to wave goodbye, likely mourning her lost possessions in the flames. In Washington, D.C., John Rainbird sits naked in his Mayflower hotel room watching the Crosswits while waiting for darkness. He plans to kill Dr. Wanless in room 1217 later that night. Rainbird is described as being at peace with nearly everything, Cap, the shop, God, Satan, though not yet completely with himself. A Cherokee who collects shoes but goes barefoot when alone, he's fascinated by only 2 things, death, particularly the moment when the soul leaves the body, and Charlie McGee. Earlier that day, Rainbird had entered Dr. Wanless's hotel room and awakened him. After threatening him, Rainbird forced Wanless to tell him everything about Charlie McGee and the Lot 6 experiments. After Wanless revealed everything, Rainbird suffocated him, studying the doctor's eyes during death with childlike eagerness. As always, he saw only puzzlement in the dying eyes, not the revelation he seeks. Rainbird wonders if killing a child, specifically Charlie McGee, might finally reveal the death secret he's been searching for. He feels tender and protective toward Charlie, convinced that the girl would be his. Before leaving, he kisses Wanless on both cheeks and covers his body with a sheet. Meanwhile, Andy and Charlie arrive at Granther McGee's remote cottage on Tashmore Pond 2 days after the incident at the Manders farm. They've traveled in Herb's Willie's Jeep, navigating secondary roads to avoid roadblocks. Charlie remains listless and withdrawn, sleeping frequently. After reaching Granther's property, Andy unlocks the chain blocking the private road. The road is badly deteriorated, showing no one has visited in years. When a fallen birch blocks their path, they continue on foot to the five-room cottage. The place stirs powerful memories for Andy of his childhood visits and times with Vicky. Charlie asks if things will ever be normal again, and Andy honestly answers that he doesn't know. The cottage is untouched since their last visit, with a well-stocked pantry, kerosene lamps, and no electricity or phone, which suits their need to remain hidden. After Charlie falls asleep, Andy takes a small glass of Granther's moonshine onto the deck. Sitting in a canvas director's chair, he looks out at the dark lake, feeling the liquor warm him against the chill. For the first time since the terrible chase up Third Avenue, he feels safe and at rest. He remembers his conversation with Quincy, who warned him about the shop wanting to use Charlie. Andy reflects on how they'd been under surveillance and how the shop made the mistake of thinking Charlie's sleepover at a friend's house meant they'd gone underground. This led to Vicky's murder and their current situation. Andy wrote 6 nearly identical letters to Ohio's 2 senators, his district's representative, the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and Toledo Blade. Each letter detailed everything from the experiment at Jason Gearney Hall through their current isolation at Tashmore Pond. He let Charlie read one, giving her the full story for the first time. She asked if they would stay together, and Andy assured her they would, though privately he was uncertain about what might happen after the letters were received. With no post office in Bradford or Tashmore, mail went through nearby teller. Robert Everett, the postman, collected Andy's 6 letters and a postcard from Miss Shirley Devine that afternoon while Andy napped and Charlie built a snowman across the lake. 5 miles outside Williams, Everett was stopped by 2 men in a beige Chevrolet Caprice. Despite his protests about interfering with U.S. mail, they forced him at gunpoint to surrender the mailbag. They took only Andy's 6 letters, leaving Everett feeling violated and shaken. By late afternoon, while Andy and Charlie played 500 rummy after dinner, Andy's intercepted letters had already reached Cap Hollister's desk, setting in motion the next phase of their ordeal. Cap Hollister awaited John Rainbird on Charlie's birthday, March 24. Recent months had taken their toll. He'd acquired bifocals, new wrinkles, and lost both his wife Georgia and Secretary Rachel to cancer. The McGee situation and Manders Farm incident had sparked doubts about his leadership, though he'd maintained control by quietly surveilling the McGees at Tashmore Pond. When Rainbird entered, his imposing frame and empty eye socket made Cap uneasy. Rainbird agreed to handle the capture with one condition: access to Charlie afterward. He wanted to befriend the isolated girl, promising to destroy his blackmail material in exchange. Cap reluctantly agreed. On March 27th, Andy McGee decided they must leave Tashmore. 2 weeks of silence following his letters suggested interception, and he discovered surveillance evidence, snowshoe tracks leading to a tree with cigarette butts and an empty film package. He planned to take Charlie to New York's Times offices. Though distressed, Charlie promised not to use her fire ability, even if caught. A dozen agents surrounded the cabin, with only Rainbird and Don Jules armed. Rainbird, secured in a tall spruce 150 yards away, watched through his scope as Andy and Charlie emerged into the spring silence. Charlie's bright blue parka made an easy target, her exposed throat perfectly aligned in his crosshairs. The tranquilizer dart struck with a soft foot. Charlie stopped at the steps, a needle protruding from her throat. Blood stained her collar as she collapsed into Andy's arms. He screamed demands into the silent woods, cradling her limp body. Don Jules emerged with his .22, and as Andy considered retreating inside, Jules shot him in the back of the neck. Andy jerked upward, still clutching Charlie, before collapsing over her. The crisis began with a summer storm and two failed generators on August 19th, 5 months into Andy and Charlie's captivity. While most shop employees ignored the gathering storm, John Rainbird's damaged face ached with the weather's approach. Rainbird maintained his orderly disguise meticulously, arriving in an old Thunderbird despite owning a VIP-worthy Cadillac. Charlie McGee remained stubbornly uncooperative despite medical intervention and psychiatric evaluation, showing sporadic aphasia but never using her fire ability. Andy McGee had gained 30 pounds, living sedated on Thorazine in a surveilled three-room apartment. Dr. Herman Pinchot's attempts to get Andy to demonstrate his push on volunteers proved futile, despite offering rewards like outdoor time. When the storm knocked out power, Andy found himself in complete darkness. His attempt to navigate to the kitchen resulted in injuries from colliding with furniture. Meanwhile, Rainbird entered Charlie's quarters, finding her in a blue Danskin leotard meditating. Though lacking a specific plan, he watched for opportunities. Charlie's 5 months of captivity felt dreamlike. She'd rejected her assigned companion, agreeing to speak only with Hochstetter. Viewing her imprisonment as punishment for being a murderer, she relived her violent acts, man aflame, exploding cars, burning chickens, and swore never to use her power again. During the blackout, Charlie confided in Rainbird about feeling imprisoned. He manipulated her trust with a fabricated Vietnam story about torture and captivity, earning her sympathy and tears. Meanwhile, Andy woke, realizing he'd broken his Thorazine addiction through unconscious self-pushing, opening new possibilities for escape. As fall approached, Charlie began attending tutoring sessions at Rainbird's suggestion. Their relationship grew as he secretly passed notes between father and daughter. During private kitchen conversations, he gradually wore down her resistance to using her abilities. 3 days after their last talk, Charlie agreed to cooperate with testing, though looking thin and troubled. Rainbird, maintaining his deception, advised her to play tough and demand compensation for each demonstration. Charlie's first test session was disastrous. She refused to cooperate, pointing out flammable hazards, the wooden table, cork walls, the technician's clothes, even the plastic camera. Most critically, she noted there was no water to extinguish potential fires. Despite her distress, Hochstetter saw her emotional state as readiness. After a 6-hour nap, Charlie was brought to a different room with safer conditions. Wood chips on a metal table, steel walls, an asbestos-clad technician, and a water-filled bathtub. She approved, but insisted Hochstetter watch from behind the glass, warning of consequences if he stayed. The demonstration exceeded expectations. The wood chips exploded, flipping the metal tray and denting steel walls. The technician fled, his cry reminding Charlie of the Albany Airport incident. She realized her power had intensified dramatically. As room temperature soared, she directed the fire toward the tub, bringing the water to an instant boil. Fighting for control, she mentally commanded, "Back off!" until the fire ceased, leaving the room like a steam bath. Hochstetter celebrated the recorded success, but his triumph deflated when he discovered Charlie had slipped away through the open door. The next day, Charlie and Rainbird visited the duck pond. She basked in the autumn sun with the relief of someone freed from confinement. At the stables, she connected instantly with a black gelding named Necromancer. Rainbird advised her to leverage her power, demanding privileges like horseback riding in exchange for test participation. "It's like poker, Charlie. If you ain't dealing from strength, why, you just ain't dealing." Meanwhile, Andy remained under constant surveillance, making minimal progress in locating Charlie beyond learning they were near Highway 301. His breakthrough came unexpectedly when Herman Pinchot committed suicide, leading to a meeting with facility director Cap Hollister. In this presumably bug-free office, Andy pushed Cap, discovering Charlie's fire demonstrations and Rainbird's manipulation, offering privileges for cooperation. Most alarming was Rainbird's plan to kill Charlie once tests concluded. Andy quickly arranged to attend Pinchot's funeral with Cap, seeing an opportunity to learn Charlie's location and plan their escape. Charlie's testing moved to the former shop chapel, now reinforced with asbestos and tempered steel. Inside stood a cinder block wall and a tank of ice water. Charlie, small in her denim jumper, faced the wall as Hockstetter observed through the intercom. The cameras captured everything, temperatures soaring past 7,000 degrees, destroying the sensor. Slow-motion footage showed mortar melting, cinder blocks exploding into flames. Charlie then instantly boiled the massive tank of ice water. Afterward, Charlie demanded to see her father. Hockstetter, troubled by a memo describing her as a crack in the very smelter of creation, realized she could potentially destroy the entire facility. His attempts to bribe her with amusement park visits failed. "I'm mad at you," she warned. "If I don't see him, I'll make something happen." Alone, Charlie broke down sobbing, torn between guilt, horror, and a disturbing pleasure in her growing powers. The tests had become a terrible but compelling game, and she sensed her abilities were far from their limit. Andy used Pinchot's funeral to manipulate Cap, despite his worsening headaches. He learned Rainbird had become Charlie's surrogate father and that she'd be killed once deemed uncooperative. Andy arranged his transfer to Hawaii for Wednesday, with Cap and minimal security accompanying them. After pushing Cap, Andy collapsed for 6 hours while blood leaked in his brain. Though aware further mental exertion could kill him, he resolved to endure long enough to help Charlie escape. Cap spent the day in a daze, experiencing strange thoughts about golf and snakes after Andy's manipulation. When Charlie refused further testing without seeing her father, Cap unexpectedly agreed to arrange it by Wednesday. Charlie received a secret note from Andy revealing Cap's manipulation and warning that Rainbird, their actual captor at Granthers, couldn't be trusted. The note outlined their escape plan to Los Angeles or Chicago, where Andy hoped to arrange a press conference through his friend Quincy. The revelation about Rainbird devastated Charlie. She faced an agonizing choice. Trust her father and accept Rainbird's betrayal, or believe in Rainbird and dismiss her father's warning. She reluctantly began questioning the authenticity of her relationship with John, examining his guarded nature and carefully crafted responses. Charlie wakes early Wednesday morning and requests a stable visit to see Necromancer, knowing it's her last interaction with Mike the guard. Meanwhile, Andy rises after a restless night of nightmares, anxiously awaiting reunion with his daughter. Rainbird, recently returned from Washington, ensures his flight cancellation deception remains undetected. At 1 o'clock, Don Jules escorts Charlie to the stables where Rainbird waits, having cleared the area. When Jules roughly grabs Charlie's wrist, she threatens him until he flees. From his hiding place, Rainbird reveals himself as her betrayer. Cap Hollister, now white-haired and mentally unstable, arrives at Andy's apartment. Andy mentally pushes him to carry a suitcase. At the stables, Charlie confronts Rainbird, who sits in the loft with a pistol. Despite her anger, she finds herself drawn to his manipulative words about ending her suffering. As she begins climbing toward him, Andy bursts in. The confrontation escalates when Rainbird threatens to shoot Andy unless Charlie comes up. As Charlie hesitates, Cap's sudden scream about an imagined snake creates a crucial distraction. Andy seizes this moment to mentally push Rainbird to jump, suffering a devastating brain blowout. Though injured from the fall, Rainbird shoots Andy in the neck before attempting to shoot Charlie. Her power erupts, instantly incinerating both Rainbird and Cap. Charlie finds her dying father in the burning stable. With his last breath, Andy urges her to escape and expose the shop's crimes, burn it all down. When agents outside open fire on fleeing horses, Charlie emerges, channeling her grief into devastating power. Fire trenches radiate from her as she systematically destroys the compound. Finally, recognizing her power's dangerous growth, Charlie directs it into the duck pond. Standing amid steam, she realizes she could affect even the sun if she chose. She weeps for her father, for John, for those she's killed, and for herself, feeling the raw instinct of survival even as she mourns. The media reports a sanitized version of a terrorist firebomb attack at a top-secret scientific think tank in Longmont, Virginia. They claim double agent John Rainbird planted bombs and died in the attack, which killed 20 and injured 45. The shop is barely mentioned, and survivors are sequestered by the government. 4 weeks later, the new shop head demands Charlie be eliminated. Though Lot 6 proposals are officially tabled indefinitely, this really means until we bring them the girl with a tag on her toe. That November, Irv Manders finds an emaciated Charlie, whom he remembers as Bobby, with a flamethrower in her head in his driveway. She collapses after pointing to the burn mark where his chopping block once stood. While recovering at the Manders, Charlie reveals through tears that her father is dead. "They killed him, and now there's nowhere I can go," she sobs. Norma embraces her as she breaks down. The Manders shelter Charlie through winter, with Irv attempting to homeschool her. By April, she demonstrates controlled use of her power, helping Irv light damp kindling. Though improving, she remains haunted by nightmares of Rainbird and struggles with poor appetite. When shop agents finally surround the farm, they find only Irv and Norma with Charlie's note. "I think I know what to do now. Love, Charlie." Charlie seeks help at the New York Public Library, asking for something honest, nationwide, with no ties to the government. Following the librarian's directions, she arrives at Rolling Stone magazine's offices. Clutching an orange and a shop and save bag, she tells the receptionist with quiet confidence, "I have a story I want to tell, and something to show." When the receptionist compares it to show and tell, Charlie smiles brilliantly. "Yes," she says, "I've been waiting for a long time."